My name is Robin Schultz, and I teach pastoral care and direct the internship program at Lutheran Seminary in Columbia, South Carolina. The edition put out by the World Council of Churches looks like this, and has some advantages in the way in which it is arranged, but is considerably more expensive. This is a document which is going to be increasingly discussed in our churches because it represents the present fruit of a long process of dialogue between the churches. And what the churches are basically trying to do, that would include the Roman Catholic Church, the Eastern Orthodox Church, and all of the churches that are members of the World Council of Churches. That would be the Lutheran churches. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is not a member of the World Council, but pays very careful attention to what the World Council does. The Presbyterian, Baptist, Methodist churches, but also Pentecostal churches and churches throughout the world. And what these churches are saying is that in the past 2,000 years of the history of the church, we have been engaged in a process in which churches have been separating from one another, have been distinguishing themselves from one another, and have done that because they have had different understandings of the apostolic faith. Those differing understandings of the apostolic faith have been partly influenced by differences in language, by differences in culture, different ways of asking the question, as well as answering it, and have often been influenced by factors that have not been primary factors in the life of the church. In other words, the reasons historically why the churches are divided are not necessarily always religious reasons. But those divisions have all been symbolized by different ways of stating the apostolic faith. The World Council of Churches is saying is now that we are in our world conscious of the fact that we are one human community and that people everywhere need to be concerned about the same questions and need to try to formulate our answers in such a way that we can converse with one another. The World Council of Churches has taken the leadership with the cooperation of the Roman Catholic Church and full participation of the Eastern churches in arriving at a common statement of the apostolic faith. Now, if you'll think about it, that is, this would seem to be an almost impossible task. Because those of you who have followed, for example, the Lutheran Roman Catholic or the Lutheran Reformed or the Lutheran Methodist dialogues, Lutheran Episcopal dialogues in this country, will be aware of just how long and difficult a process it is to go back and try to relive our various histories and to say, at these points, we were much closer to one another than we thought. And we were saying very often, trying to say things that were relatively the same, but did so in ways that were comparatively different. So the root of dialogue, the root of the dialogues up until now, has been the root of going back and examining the old questions and seeing if we can arrive at some form of agreement. However, there is another approach. And that is the approach which is taken by this document. I ask those of you who have been, were here last week to be patient. If you listen to the tapes, you will hear some of this on each Monday's tape, because I think it is very important background to this document. This document, in trying to arrive at a common statement of the apostolic faith, says, let's see if there are any ways of stating the apostolic faith that we can agree on. In the first stage, the questions had to do with baptism, Eucharist, and ministry. So, the Faith and Order Commission of the World Council said, we understand that there are disagreements. There is no way of pretending that there are not. We know a lot about those disagreements. We don't know a lot about our agreement. So let's take individual statements about baptism, Eucharist, and ministry, and put them into paragraphs, and see if everyone can agree to those paragraphs. Now, that's an interesting question, interesting way. Because what you have in the paragraphs are answers. What the document does not provide you with are questions. Now that can frustrate you. Because, for example, relationship to baptism. If you go to the Baptists and you say, do you baptize adults? Yes, we baptize adults. You go to the Lutherans and you say, do you baptize adults? Lutherans say, of course we baptize adults. You have an agreement. Lutherans and Baptists are agreed that the church baptizes adults. That's a convergence. What is called a convergence? It's called a convergence rather than a full agreement, because it does not raise the question about the baptizing of infants. That is raised elsewhere, right? And is noted as a point that needs further discussion. So if you can think of yourselves as think of a group of people being given a selection of answers, and being asked, could you give these answers to some kinds of questions? If you could, then there is convergence. It's not agreement, because we're still not answering the same question. But we could at least begin to say it in the same way. Now then we have that convergence. And the next point is that when you have that convergence, then you continue your conversation on the basis of the convergence. There is a way of basing a conversation on disagreement. You come together and you say, what's important is not the things on which we agree, those can be taken for granted. But what is important are the points on which we disagree. That's what we need to talk about. That's what we need to work out. And that kind of a conversation in the church will usually end in a statement of disagreement and a separation. Now the method that is being tried is to say, no matter how small our basis of our agreement is, no matter how small the points are at which we are able to converge, we are going to talk about that convergence. And when we raise a question and recognize that we disagree on it, then we're going to note that we raise that question and disagree, and we're going to stop talking about it and go back and talk about what we do agree on. And that is a way which has proved to be extremely fruitful, and a way which has produced the very startling results that you have in this document. That is, that this document contains statements which theologians representing the full range of the churches, from Eastern Orthodox and Roman Catholic to Pentecostal, have been able to say, yes, we could say it that way. We go back into our own churches and talk about the doctrine of baptism, or talk about the Eucharist, or talk about ministry. There are a lot of other things that we will want to talk about, but we're not going to talk about those here because they will lead to disagreement. We may note that those are questions that still need to be discussed, and this document does that. We are not ignorant of the fact that there are those differences, but we will, what is important for us is that we have been able to agree. So this is an unprecedented kind of document. It's now being circulated to the churches. And the Lutheran Church in America responded to it in its at its convention in Toronto. And later this week, we can talk about that response. It will be circulated to the other churches that are member churches of the World Council of Churches. And after it has been received by them, as I fully expect it will be by almost all of the churches involved, it will be passed on by them to the congregations with the request that people talk about this. Yes?
We've been studying it since last. I belonged to an ADLC church. And uh-huh. We started last fall, and we've gotten through baptism and Eucharist, so you see we spent a lot of time on it.
We've sure
gotten to ministries.
Okay. Well, then you're an expert at this.
No, I'm not an expert.
Well, you certainly are. Mm-hmm. Expert means someone who's experienced, and you're experienced in discussing.
A lot of discussion on.
We've been discussing it too in the LCA group in Thousand Oaks.
Oh.
Pastor Segerman.
Aha. Uh-huh. Good. It's amazing.
Her bishop.
Yeah. Well, there are people. Well, there are churches where it is being discussed. I didn't expect to have two represented here. This is a little preamble. It has to do with the nature of the document. So, because I think that when I first read this document, I found it very frustrating, and I kept saying, "But when they say that, but they don't mean the same thing by it necessarily. They're not answering the same questions, and they're bypassing disagreements." And I always have to back up and say, well, but they're doing that because they have agreed upon this method. They don't talk about the method in the document.
Yeah, but if they're bypassing the disagreements, I don't understand. You have to reconcile disagreements too, don't you?
Well, you do. But... If I think I see that you're married.
Oh, yes.
Okay. You probably have some disagreements with your husband.
Of course.
Okay. It's possible if you're, like, we have some disagreements at times. I think other people do. Now, if you were to go home from Hobart and you were going to say, I've been thinking about things here, and had a chance to be away and really understand that we have some disagreements. And I don't think we've been taking those disagreements seriously. As a matter of fact, I think the points on which we are disagreed are really the most important points, and unless we can reach agreement on them, I'm leaving. If you would say that.
To my husband?
To your husband.
I'm leaving my husband?
Yeah.
No way.
No way. No, well, I'm not suggesting that you should. But if you were to say to him, the disagreements that we have are really the essential thing, and unless we can, that's what we want to pay attention to. Now, what you actually do in life, in maintaining a relationship, is to focus on the agreements, and to work on the disagreements, but to work on the disagreements on the basis of the agreement that you have.
You think so?
I think so, too.
No, I don't.
You don't? How do you think it happens?
I think that I work on the disagreement and not the agreement, because the agreement is already there, and the disagreement is something that you have to work on to make disappear.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, that's certainly a, you know, that is one possibility.
So you say this book is on all the agreements, right? Of all the various different World Council churches, right?
Right.
I think they're going backwards.
Well,
I think you have to read, when you read that book, every sentence is important. If you're going to get the real meaning of what these people are saying through all their study and all that they've done, you need to read it and study it very carefully.
Yes, you do.
And you're talking about this, about getting together on your agreements. About 17 years ago, my son married a Catholic girl. And we had problems at first. We finally said, there are certain things that we certainly agree on in our separate religions, the Catholic and the Lutheran. Let's always be joyful in the things that we agree on.
But it would also have been possible, and there was a long time when that would have been taken for granted, that you would have said that since there are disagreements between the Lutheran and the Roman Catholic religion, that marriage will never work.
It's a beautiful marriage.
It's a beautiful marriage. It does work. Well, it's a useful question, and I invite your attention to it. But I don't assume that all of you are going to approve of the method. But I think it proves very, very fruitful. I'm sorry that you come on the third week when we're dealing with ministry.
So am I.
Because I think that baptism and Eucharist might have given us a more fruitful way of examining the kinds of questions which you raise. So I'd like to look with you at this document and what it says about ministry. And start with the page 29. I realize many of you don't have it yet, and I will always read any passages that I'm specifically referring to. The document begins with part one, the calling of the whole people of God. By the way, some of you may have been on your way to the dining room and may realize that you're in the wrong session. I don't know the title of the session that's next door, but it's
Study on St. Luke.
Study on St. Luke. So if that's what you're we're looking for, that's where it is. The calling of the whole people of God. And I'd like to raise a question for you. And that is, who are the whole people of God? And I'd like to give you three alternatives. One is, clergy. Second is, the baptized. And the third is, all people. Say, simple question. And each of you will have an instinctive reaction to it. The whole people of God. And now, if you've decided which of these three groups come closest to your understanding of the whole people of God, then I'd like you to ask, which of these three groups have a calling to ministry? Have a calling. Which of these three have a calling? Yes.
What do you mean by call?
Well, whatever that word means for you. You have your answer?
Well, we didn't study, we got to the ministry, so I this is all new to me now. I looked at home, I didn't know we were going to study this. But the whole sentence of this says, the broken word caused for the whole humanity of God. And Jesus Christ died for the whole humanity, not just for the clergy or the baptized. He died for all of humanity.
And we're all supposed to be disciples and go out and talk about God. Mm-hmm.
That's pretty obvious, I think. Humanity.
Humanity.
It has to be.
Is the whole people of God?
I would think so.
And is all of humanity called by God?
No, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. And I think that I could give you some authority for that in the third article, the explanation of the third article of the Creed. Luther talks about God calling, gathering, enlightening, and sanctifying the whole Christian church on earth.
I believe we're all called by God, but it's our choice whether we are listening to him or not.
Okay. But is it just the church that is called? Mm-hmm. Or is it all people who are called?
All people probably are called, but all people are not able.
Uh-huh.
Responsive.
Well, at the...
We're all able. There's all different ways of ministry. It's not just going on and preaching. I mean, even how we're raising our children or talking to a friend over coffee, it's all ways of ministry, even by our actions.
Now, you said that that you understand the whole people of God, his humanity, but you also said that we're all called to ministry.
Well, he said, didn't he tell to go make disciples of all
people? Who is it, which of these three groups is called to ministry?
Humanity.
Humanity is called to ministry.
I think it's baptized.
The baptized are called to ministry. But you see what difficult kinds of questions we're dealing with. And questions about which we all have very traditional ways of thinking.
I think that all humanity is called, and it may not be a Christian response that humanity gives, but all humanity can help other people, you know, in kindness and in deeds of love. They may not know Christ and be a Christian, but they can still be ministering to other people without saying, I'm doing this in the name of the Lord Jesus.
Let me give you a little historical background to the development of this question. And you can kind of peg yourself in, see how you feel about that. At the end of the 15th century, just before the Reformation, there were two kinds. It was considered that in the Western world that everyone was a Christian, except for the Jewish people who were excluded from society. They were ghettoized. They at the time also agreed with that because that helped them preserve their identity, but the church also wanted them to be ghettoized because it was important to recognize that everybody was baptized, that everybody in the community was a Christian. If everybody in the community was a Christian, then everybody was baptized. And all of those baptized people lived in the world. From time to time, however, God called someone to leave life in the world and to enter religious life. That was a calling. The Latin word for calling is vocation. If you had a vocation to religious life, you left the world. Luther had a vocation to religious life. It came by that lightning bolt that hit right next to him on the ground and left him so afraid that he finally said yes to the calling that he had been struggling with. When he had that calling, he left the world. He entered into a religious community. He lived by a different set of rules. He had been called, and he was a religious person. And those were the only people who had a calling. They had been called out of the world into the cloister, into the nunnery, or into the monastery. Because they had been called out in that time, they lived under different laws, they had different courts, they even had their own prison system. Other people were under the so-called secular laws, the laws of this world, of this age. Religious people were not. Now, one of Luther's great Reformation breakthroughs in the 16th century was his assertion that all people who are baptized have a calling. Every Christian has a calling to serve God in whatever it is that it is has become your duty and your obligation to do. That is as much a calling from God as the calling to religious life. And that the callings of God are most often not callings out of the community, but are callings in service to the community. So Luther would emphasize, every Christian has a vocation. Now Luther did that in the context of a situation in which everybody, except for the Jewish community, were Christians. There were the Turks and so forth elsewhere in the world, but they were too far away to really worry about. The real problem was, how are we going to describe what's happening here in Saxony and in other parts of the German-speaking community? And in that situation, Luther could say, every Christian is called by God. Now, that was a radical change over against the 15th century. in which it said, not just the 15th century had said, not all clergy are called. If you're just a priest, you're not called, you're only called if you go into religious life. And so that was when you were called and entered a religious community, then you were considered to have a profession. You lived according to a certain rule. The only professionals at that time were professed members of religious communities, monks and nuns, who had been accepted. And so you get the people who were living in the community but had not yet been accepted were novices. They weren't professionals. They were new at it. Now, what the Reformation brought about was a radical change in thinking about vocation and about a whole variety of related terms. Now, when Luther said, you need to understand, when Luther said, in that situation, all who are baptized have a vocation, that was very much like saying all of humanity has a vocation, with the exception of that troubling question of the Jews. And that's a question that Luther never really found an answer for that we would find acceptable. He could only do it by way of excluding the Jewish people from these statements. As you know, in the process, said some things that we now wish he hadn't. But he did, because they didn't fit this pattern. They had been called by God, but they had rejected the call. Now, we, however, live in a different kind of world. We live in a world in which you cannot assume that everyone is baptized. As a matter of fact, most children who are born are not baptized. I think that would be the case, wouldn't it? I don't think that the church has baptized 50% of the children who are born these days. I may be wrong on that. But if so, I'm not very far wrong. Certainly not in our country. Although there are many more people baptized than people who are active members of the church. Okay. Now, when we, in this situation, want to speak about God's calling to people, whom has God called? Are we going to say, as the 15th century did, that only the monastic community has been called? Are we going to continue Luther's language that the baptized have been called, which Luther understood in terms of the whole community? Or are we going to take the intent of Luther's language, or perhaps not the intent of Luther's language, we can't really know how Luther would have resolved this issue, and talk about all humanity being called by God?
Where would the priesthood of all believers come into that?
That's a very significant question. And that's one that we want to look at. Let me just throw out something for you to think about until we come to it. We've set that topic aside for Friday. You're going to be here Friday? Okay. But let me just throw out something for you to think about. And that is that the New Testament nowhere refers to any special group of people in the church as being priests. That is language that is reserved for the whole people of God. And the question that you raise is the question as to if all of humanity is called by God, is all of humanity called by God to ministry? And does all of humanity exercise ministry? We've already begun to see that we have that there are some different ways of looking at that. The World Council, yes, I'm sorry.
I was just wondering, it depends on the ministry.
Ah.
You know, there's a lot of difference.
Sure is. All right. It depends upon the ministry. And with that statement, you have the clue to what the difference is between lay and ordained ministry. The ministry of the baptized, the ministry of all people. Now you see how you get convergence. If we say, are we willing to say that all of the baptized are in some sense called by God? I think we're all, from what I heard, willing to say that. We have convergence. In this group, we might have a little more difficulty getting everyone to accept the first statement of this document. In a broken world, God calls the whole of humanity to become God's people. Or we may not. That may be a statement that all of us will easily agree. Is the call to become one of God's people something which comes to us in a specific, individual way in the course of our life, and we then respond or do not respond? Or is that a call that is given to us by reason of the fact that we are human, that we are God's creatures?
John 3:16.
Well, God loved the world, didn't he? But Paul also says that, talks about the calling of the Christian. And there are some phrases back there that are a little more difficult to work with. Because Paul says if he has called you, he will justify you, and let's see, whom God has called, he has also, how does that passage go? I don't have it in my...
Ordained, is it?
Pardon?
Preordained, or...
I can't remember it. I'll have to look it up. I can't even tell you where it is, because I did not... it's a passage which Paul drops in talking about the Christian life.
One of the things that, raise another point? One of the things that I find happening in the couple of weeks sitting in on this session is that my treasuring of my baptism as an infant has been important to me, because it was a sign of a relationship between me and God that predates my capacity to choose it, that establishes it before I could even say yes or no, and therefore is a fact which is of greater importance and holds me when I can't say yes,
mm-hmm.
When I don't feel able to, for whatever reason. And now, looking at the call this way, as being a call which comes from having been called into being by God, is a very, is kind of a new way
and also a very powerful way, which doesn't mean just me, but means everyone, and therefore calls me to relationship with everyone, because they are related to God in the same way that I am, which is really neat. That's not a very good word for it. It's very powerful and exciting.
I don't even know what she just said.
I don't express myself very well, maybe. Perhaps you can clarify.
I don't understand. I do.
You think you, would you mind?
No, well, no, I can't enlarge on it. I think she said it pretty well. Her baptism, she realized that she's very special. She's a very special child of God. And that because she belongs to God, she has a way of being able to spread.
I also to be very careful that you don't count anybody out in your eye, because probably in God's eyes nobody's really counted out.
Yes.
When you're baptized, when I was baptized, I had nothing to do with it. My parents said my father to left that baptismal font. I had nothing to do with that.
Yes. And is that something which you consider to be that you were baptized without having anything to do with it? Does that seem to you to be more meaningful? Is being baptized?
I don't think it has too terribly much meaning when I had no choice in it.
Mm-hmm. Right. So
I had to grow into that.
Uh-huh. So it had meaning only as you grew into it.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I mean, this big deal about, you know, baptism and all that. My kids, I had them baptized because I had been baptized, and you grow into baptism.
All right. Now there are two different perspectives that have been expressed, and that were also discussed, that were discussed in the baptism section as being the positions of different people who were represented in these conversations. And they said, yes, we're aware of that difference. Some of us value baptism as a given reality in our lives. Others of us emphasize that baptism is something that we have to grow into. We are all agreed, however, that people should be baptized.
That's right. I mean, I buy that.
I just feel we forget the work of the Holy Spirit beginning when we're baptized. And I would hate to think that he wouldn't begin his work until I said, okay, start in. You know,
that's God's love for us without us doing anything. He shows God's gift and love to us.
But then, okay, then you have the Baptists themselves who baptize when the children are old enough to understand.
Right. They grow into baptism and then are baptized.
Through understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but somehow they dedicate the children when they're little, so there's something that must be believed. That
what do you mean by dedication?
I don't know what they mean, but they dedicate
no,
their children.
I think their dedication is primarily taking their children to church every Sunday.
No, it's a special ceremony.
But it's a special ceremony that is considered to be meaningful primarily to the parents.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get across. It's I'm sorry, but I don't, you know, all this business with babies being...
But who can understand baptism any better if you are 1 hour old and being baptized? How can you understand how God comes to you? It's a simple gift. You don't understand it any better when you are 1 hour old or if you are 79 and the next day you're going to be 80. You don't understand it any better. It's a gift that God gives to you. You can't understand it. It's an acceptance.
Right. Now,
it's a growth.
What we need to do is
it's not an acceptance. I think the word acceptance is I don't buy the word acceptance.
You are accepting God's gift.
I think it's a growth.
What we need to do here is to practice convergence. This is a great opportunity.
Right here, we're leaving on our Holy Spirit.
Well,
as you grow, and I don't think you're going to understand it a whole lot more, because it is still this gift that you are getting.
Yes.
Wish you folks had been here for the during the first week we discussed Baptist, because you've raised, in the first 30 minutes, you've raised many of the questions that we had to struggle to lift to consciousness there. I'd like to do two things with this. One is to say that we would agree, I would think, that if it is true that God calls all of humanity, as this first sentence says, God calls the whole of humanity to become God's people, that sentence does not eliminate the possibility that there is some difference between being baptized and not being baptized. But being baptized does make a difference. That the question as to whether the church should preferably baptize people as infants or adults is one of those questions that we are not agreed upon. We are, however, agreed that everyone who believes in Jesus should be baptized. And there are none of us.
Would you repeat that, please?
Yes, we're convinced that everyone who believes in Jesus should be baptized.
Okay.
Right? That there is something about baptism which goes together with being a Christian. It's a command, and but the question as to whether we should baptize people as infants or adults is one that we may not come to agreement upon. Now, if we discuss that disagreement, the disagreement will become more well-defined, will become deeper, and we will have more statements of disagreement. And that is the route which the church has tried for many centuries. If, however, we say at this point, we are going to note the fact that there is disagreement among us as to whether or not people should preferably be baptized as adults or as infants, we've noted that. However, we want to go on and discuss the meaning of baptism. Then we're traveling the route which leads toward convergence. Not toward agreement, but toward convergence. And it may be that we will have noted some disagreements which we will never succeed in resolving. But what will hold us together is that we are agreed. Yeah. Is that a possibility?
Yes.
And that is the difficult route which the people preparing baptism, Eucharist, and ministry follow. Now you see, if it's important to realize that this statement about God calling the whole of humanity to become God's people is the first sentence in a discussion of ministry. It would have been possible to have started this document by saying, for example, that God, through his ministers, calls certain people to be his own people. But here the calling is accepted by all of the participants as something which is a given before the work of ministry.
In other words, if it would be through the ministers, then there's a difference in class. Some have a higher calling than others.
If it were only through the ministry, if the calling came through the work of ministry, then only those people would be called who had been in some way individually affected by the work of ministry. Now, our topic for today is ministry, lay, and ordained. And I want you to, if you will, to visualize this board as being humanity. Or human people. Humanity is a word I have a little difficulty with. Seems to me to be somewhat abstract. But if you think of this board in the language of this document as being all of humanity, and now if you say we're going to talk about ministry, ministry to whom? If we're talking about ministry to humanity, then we're talking about ministry of all the baptized. Which says, all of humanity, all people are called. It is the service of all of the baptized to treat these people as people whom God has called. Over against that, we're going to talk about ordained ministry. As being a ministry which is a ministry within the baptized. Now, we're going to talk about ordained ministry. As ministry to the baptized. Now, it's important to realize is that the baptized are also part of humanity. Ordained ministry is a ministry that is ordered, set aside for a special relationship within the baptized. But all who are baptized have a ministry to all of the people whom God has called, including the other baptized. Ordained ministry is a ministry in the church which identifies a special function only in relationship to the baptized. Yes?
I see a real parallel here, and I don't know if you're planning to point it out. Or,
I don't know.
You know,
let's
try. But the way God planned and structured the nation of Israel is the same structure. identically. I mean, you have the whole of the nations, the Gentiles, God chooses a single nation out of that, which would be similar to the baptized here, the group of God's chosen people. And within that, you have your Levites and priests that are chosen by God to perform specific functions in ministry and worship in the community.
Okay. Let me read to you the second sentence from the World Council document. Do you have it in front of you? You have it there?
Yeah.
Okay. You said it very well. For this purpose, God chose Israel. God chose Israel in order to carry out a special function in relationship to the rest of the world, and then spoke in a unique and decisive way in Jesus Christ, God's Son. So Jesus' ministry, right, is also a ministry to humanity. Jesus' ministry is not a ministry to the church, but Jesus' ministry is a ministry to humanity. Jesus made his own the nature, condition, and cause of the whole human race, giving himself as a sacrifice for all. Now, that would mean then that if we ask which of these two is closest to the ministry of Jesus, we would have to say it's the ministry of the baptized. Because the subject of that ministry is the whole of humanity, just as Jesus' ministry is the whole of humanity. Now, Jesus' life of service, his death and resurrection, are the foundation of a new community which is built up continually by the good news of the gospel and the gifts of the sacrament. Oh my. So, if you think of this, as being the boundary of the core, being the boundary of humanity, that within humanity Jesus builds a new community which we'll pick up on this diagram tomorrow. He builds up on a new community made up of people who are human beings who are brought into this new community the church. And the point at which we'll want to pick up tomorrow and go on with our discussion of the document even though that may seem to put us a little bit behind schedule, is that the relationship between lay and ordained ministry is part of the relationship between humanity and the new community. And that ordained ministry then is not a separate form of ministry different from the ministry of the baptized, but is a special form of that same ministry which takes place within this community. So the ministry of the laity is the larger ministry, is the ministry that is closest to Jesus' own ministry, and that is the basis of ordained ministry. So our time is up. Some of you need to get to the first setting. We try to keep the time boundaries here.
I'll be glad to stay and continue the discussion with any of those of you who want to. But if you're coming back tomorrow, you'll find it helpful to get the book, Baptism Eucharist Ministry, and to, if possible, to read through pages 37. We won't get that far, but we'll be working with some of that material. Thank you.